Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. And our topic is deflation. Should we fear it, or should we say, hooray for deflation? Folks, I think today's show is going to be one of the most important shows of all of ours so far. First we have is our special commentator, Mr. Patrick Barron, who is a banking consultant and also teaches an introductory course in Austrian economics, which we here on Radio Free Market like to refer to as reality economics, at the University of Iowa. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Michael.
Yeah, welcome, and thank you for being here with us today.
Glad to be here.
So, folks, our special guest today is Mr. Doug French, who is the president of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. So let's first talk about inflation so folks can get a complete picture of why we are saying hooray for deflation. People think inflation is just being prices going up, and this is part of it, but it is what we see. But people do not commonly understand why we have inflation. Doug, would you please explain what is the root cause of inflation in the first place?
Well, we should first go back to the original definition of inflation, which has been somewhat lost in the modern era. But if you find an old dictionary somewhere, you'll find that the definition of inflation is actually an increase in the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's not the way inflation is referred to today. Inflation is referred to as an increase in the overall price level. Well, that's a result of an increase in the money supply, but that's not the actual true meaning. But what this when we talk about inflation, it starts with the government creating more money out of nowhere,
out of thin air
through the banking system with the help of the Federal Reserve, and of course the Treasury's involved. And this really serves as a silent tax. I think a lot of people forget that, you know, they look at all the things that the government is doing, fighting wars here and there and social programs and increasing the government's involvement in health care, and they say, wow, where's all that money come from? My taxes may have gone up somewhat, but seems like we have bigger government than we have greater overt taxation, and they do it by a silent tax, and it is through this inflation that we're talking about.
But in the economy, the direct result also is that businesses take this as a signal that they should expand, and this creates for them a malinvestment, you know, on a broad scale.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that many people in business view that if they're able to raise their prices, that this somehow means that they are successful, and that that's a signal to them that they should put more resources into the business that they may be in or the investment they may be in. And that may not be true at all, but they're fooled by this investment. And in fact, a number of really poor operators are propped up by inflation. They're fooled by inflation. I used to lend money for a living and lent money to home builders, actually. And there were home builders who weren't necessarily good at what they did. And they took too long, and they didn't get their homes built within budget and on time. But with rising prices, by the time they sold the homes, they sold at a higher price, so they actually thought they were doing the right thing, when in fact they weren't.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back in just a minute, folks. Stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking about hooray for deflation with Doug French. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me is Mr. Doug French, the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, And also, as our special commentator, Mr. Patrick Barron, who is teaching an introductory course at the University of Iowa in Austrian economics. And we're talking about Hooray for Deflation, but we were just kind of reviewing the basics about inflation. And Doug, where you were at before the break is you were talking about how actually in this whole conversation of the boom and the bust, it is really the boom that's the problem. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the main difference between the Austrians and some of the other schools of thought, especially the Keynesians, is that the Austrians view the boom as the problem. That is when the malinvestments are created. That is when the government's intervention into the monetary market is manifested in the building of too many real estate projects or too many casinos or whatever it may be. And ultimately there isn't the demand for these projects, but that's where the money goes. Prices increase. It's done through the commercial banking system, through increased loans. And there are people who benefit by inflation. I mean, we have to remember that part of the reason that deflation is looked down upon is that there's a number of groups in society that benefit from inflation.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally those who get the money first. That's
right.
What Murray Rothbard always told us in class so long ago, is that those who get the money first get to spend it first and before the prices go up.
Mm-hmm. But for everybody else, their purchasing power actually decreases because they get to use that money later. And this especially hurts savers, elderly, people on fixed incomes and the like.
That's so exactly right.
Let's establish this as a summary on inflation. Inflation is really a bad thing that everyone needs to learn more about. It's bad for business. It's bad for consumers. It's bad for jobs. It's bad for savers and elderly. And it's really bad for our children and progeny. Now, Pat, would you say that's a good summary?
Yeah, I would. I think one of the problems is that, as Doug mentioned very early on, is we have to get our definition straight. And when most people, I think if you ask most people, do they think inflation is a good thing? They would say no, you know, because they know that inflation means that they're paying more for gasoline at the pump and bread at the supermarket, but they don't know why that is. And so they are very much, you know, they're four square behind the very policies that got us, that caused the inflation, because there's just an ignorance of economics.
Okay, so let's now go over to deflation, and let's start by talking about the concept of falling prices, which is, of course, one definition of deflation, which is actually good for consumers and savers and long-term economic calculation. And I actually wanted to start with a paraphrasing of a quote from Gita Holzman's book, Deflation and Liberty, which we have actually featured on our website at radiofreemarket.com. Inflation hides the winners and the losers. Deflation exposes the winners and the losers. Doug, would you mind explaining this quote a little bit more?
Well, it's a wonderful quote, and Guido's done wonderful work. But as I was explaining in the previous segment, entrepreneurs are fooled by rising prices, and may or may not be effective in using the factors of production. Because even though they're not being timely in preparing their product or service, as the price continually goes up, they believe that they're actually using the factors of production to their best use. But it's really entrepreneurs are being fooled by that inflation, the fact that more and more money is being pumped into the economy. Conversely, as Professor Holzman points out, as prices continually fall, then it's those who use the factors of production best, those that are more efficient, those that can lower their costs over time, those are the ones, those are the entrepreneurs that are really the ones that are advancing society and making things better off for all of us. And it's deflation that that exposes them for the great things that they do.
And now, deflation actually punishes debt, and it rewards savings.
Right.
And so we're really talking about the non-sustainable economy based on debt and inflation versus a more sustainable economy based on savings, investment, production, and deflation, meaning gently lowering of prices. Would that be correct?
That's exactly right. As prices can gently fall as entrepreneurs become more and more efficient at their processes. And actually real wages, in turn go up. So for the normal working person who now can tell that they're further and further behind, even though the government says, oh, we have no, there's no inflation or prices are flat, we all know that whatever raises we get are never enough. But real wages actually go up in gently falling prices. And Murray Rothbard's made the point that that if you want an increase in real wages, you need three things: an absence of inflation, an increase in savings, and capital formation. And of course, as you mentioned rightly, savings benefit during a deflationary period. People have the incentive to save more because that savings will be worth more over time as prices fall. That savings is turned into capital formation. That capital formation makes labor more efficient, more productive, and that leads to increases in real wages.
Okay, so let's now go back in time to when in the fall of 2008 all of the talking heads in the mainstream media were saying how grateful they were that the government stepped in to avoid the whole financial world from collapsing. How did these talking heads justify this thinking?
Well, in their view, the economy was on the edge of the abyss. The entire financial system was going to fail, and if it failed, then we would all end up in this deflationary spiral, and that we would all be doomed. No one would have a job. We would be trying to sell each other apples on street corners, and you know all these things that that they dreamed up. If Citicorp wasn't bailed out, or Fannie and Freddie, or any of these various large financial institutions, and it was all on the idea that if the financial system were left to collapse, that prices would collapse, and if prices collapsed, then consumers wouldn't buy anything. The consumer would say, well, gee, I'm not going to buy a computer today if it will get cheaper tomorrow, or food or apples or anything. And of course, this is nonsense. We all pay for goods and services as we need them. Computer prices and other prices have fallen through technology over the years. It doesn't keep us from buying these goods and services when we need them.
It doesn't put those businesses out of business either.
And it certainly doesn't put those businesses out of business. But to hear the talking heads on TV, to hear the Larry Summers in the White House, or Ben Bernanke, there's this great fear of falling prices. There's this great fear of deflation. And they do all they can to prop up prices, and that's really what the bailouts were all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noted that, you know, Larry Summers, who's a principal economic advisor to Obama, has said deflation is the real risk facing the economy, and therefore there's their justification for the stimulus and the bailouts based on their perception of our economic security. But as you point out in this excellent article that you have on Mises.org, called Failure and Prosperity, you know, financial failures and falling prices do not mean depression and stagnant economy, you know, automatically.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. Summers is essentially a Keynesian. The Keynesian view would would be that unlike the Austrians, the Keynesians believe that depressions, instead of being a cleansing period from the previous boom and malinvestment, Keynesians believe that depression is a failure in demand, in aggregate demand. So the Keynesians want to use the government to replace the private sector in terms of creating private demand. And that's why they constantly reach for the same prescription.
Let's go back into history, and actually we're going to talk about this period in the late 1800s from about 1870 or so right through the end of the 1800s, because as you point out, many historians describe this period of between 1873 and 1896 as a deflationary dark age. I know it was not easy to find good materials other than those through Mises.org and homeschooling my teenage daughter on this particular period. But let's start talking about that particular story about what happened in that particular period, because there was a very substantial economic crash and in 1873, and really good times happened after that. So we're going to talk about this more right after the break, folks. This is Michael McKay. You're listening to Radio Free Market, and I have Mr. Doug French and Mr. Patrick Barron, and we're going to talk about Hooray for Deflation right after we get back. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, talking with Mr. Doug French and Patrick Barron on deflation and Hooray for Deflation. So, Doug, we were just talking about the crash of 1873. This is not an economic event that most Americans are aware of. Would you briefly discuss it and describe for us what happened there?
Sure. I think if most people go to the crash of 1873 and they'll look it up on Wikipedia and other places, they'll be misled into believing that this was a dark two decades of depression, that this was an awful time in U.S. Economic history. And it's really exactly the opposite. It was actually one of the most prosperous periods in U.S. economic history.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to steal your thunder a little bit here. James Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, I'm going to quote him, "You can look far and wide without finding a decade so ebullient, prosperous, and in so many ways so modern as that of the 1880s. So the crash of 1873 really brought upon us a terrific explosion of prosperity. What happened in 1873?
Actually, in 1873, there were a couple of failures, and it didn't just start in the United States. Like the financial crash of 2008, the crash of 1873 really started in Europe, moved across Europe, and then the big failure in the United States was the fall of the house of Jay Cooke, if you will.
And that is C-O-O-K-E, Jay Cooke.
Yeah, C-O-O-K-E, yeah. And Jay Cooke was not only a big financier, but he also owned the Northern Pacific Railroad. So very important guy. If he wasn't the biggest banker, he was certainly the most influential. He had monopoly on underwriting all of the debt securities for the United States government. He had a 53-room mansion in just north of Philadelphia on 200 acres. He was a multimillionaire. He had the ear of all politicians. And this is a guy who was tremendously, tremendously connected. Like, say, some Wall Street firms that are connected today, like the Goldman Sachs and some of the others on Wall Street. But the difference in 1873 was that they allowed Jay Cook, when he got in trouble, to fail.
Mm-hmm. He basically just pyramided himself by expanding his debt fallaciously.
That's correct. They floated bonds, especially for the Northern Pacific Railroad, which was essentially a little bit of flim-flammery, if you will. He had bond salesmen out there telling people that the climate in Northwest United States was very similar to that of the Mediterranean, making people believe that they had a very temperate, wonderful climate up there to build this railroad, and stacked up all this railroad debt, and that combined with the banking operation that he had collapsed.
So, Pat, you were actually saying that Jay Cook's operation was basically akin to Goldman Sachs today.
Well, I read Doug's wonderful essay on Mises.org, and I was just struck by how in 1873, Jay Cook probably was as powerful relative to the size of the economy as Goldman Sachs is now, and yet he collapsed, and the real underlying economy progressed on. Of course, those who held Cook's bonds weren't happy, but I think it's akin to the Goldman Sachs that we bailed out 100 cents on the dollar for their toxic paper. The government did, with taxpayer money. And if we had allowed Goldman Sachs to fail, I think the underlying economy would have chugged right along. As it is, the underlying economy is still bearing the burden of Goldman Sachs.
Right. So back then, what happened in the 1800s or 1880s is that as you report, Doug, the U.S. economy really moved from agricultural into manufacturing. But while prices fell every year, the U.S. economy, you know, prospered, industry expanded, railroads expanded, physical output, net national product, real capital, per capita income all roared ahead in the 1880s. And so this is a remarkable, phenomenal growth that occurred during that particular period of time, rather than this threat of a severe depression that everyone is using as the justification to avoid, you know, this deflation ghost that is being presented to us.
Yeah, historians view it as a depression because prices fell. And sure, prices fell by 3.8% per year.
Mm-hmm. But
there's nothing bad about that.
Purchasing power went ahead.
That's exactly right. Real wages went up. Net national product, real national product went up. The per capita growth was phenomenal. So the failure of Jay Cook set off two decades of prosperity.
Yeah, I want to talk more about this wages going up, because you had mentioned they went up over 20%. This is Radio Free Market. We're going to take another brief break. Please stay with us. Thank you very much. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me is Mr. Doug French, president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Now, Doug, many economists and historians believe that falling prices equal bad times. But that's just not true, is it?
No, it's not at all. Falling prices mean our dollars are worth more. So if you have $100 in your pocket and prices suddenly begin to fall, that means you can buy more with that $100. And more people in all income brackets benefit as prices fall. We've already talked about the fact that inflation tends to benefit those who get the money first, and those are typically people at the higher income brackets. But deflation actually helps people in all income brackets, and especially those with lower incomes and not as much wealth, because that wealth will go farther. So, and that's really the definition of prosperity. That's when everyone's standard of living improves as goods become more affordable.
And you have this wonderful quote by Murray Rothbard that explains what these economists have overlooked.
Yeah, Murray said it very eloquently, as he always does, and I would invite your listeners to pick up any book by Murray. But Murray makes the case. He says the fact that in the natural course of events, when government and the banking system do not increase the money supply very rapidly, free market capitalism will result in an increase in production and economic growth so great as to swamp the increase of the money supply. Prices will fall, and the consequences will be not depression or stagnation, but prosperity, since costs are falling too, economic growth, and the spread of the increased living standard to all consumers.
Yeah, well, thank you. I love that quote. Thank you very much. So let's go back in history for a minute, back to this panic of 1873, which did topple these bloated banks and railroads into bankruptcy. Tell us about that a little bit more.
Well, 1873 rolled around, and again, Jay Cooke and Company, as we described, was a very powerful government bond dealer, and also he controlled Northern Pacific Railroad. And something else I didn't mention before is that just to show how tied in he was with the government at the time, he benefited from 47 million acres worth of land grants from the federal government.
47 million acres.
That's right. So he made it his business to be close to government, and he certainly reaped the benefits by being granted extensive land grants to expand his railroad. But you know, the mighty House of Cooke fell apart in 1873, as we described, and
filed for bankruptcy.
He indeed did file for bankruptcy. And
you'd mentioned that this panic of 1873 was actually a worldwide affair.
Yeah, it actually
like
started
the panic of
stock market crash in Vienna, and then also in Berlin throughout Europe. The New York Warehouse and Security Company also failed, and then finally Jay Cooke's firm failed. So if people want to try to cloak this as, well, you're just talking about Jay Cooke, and this really wasn't a worldwide event like, say, what happened in 2008, well, I think the two are very analogous. This was very much a worldwide financial crash. And it took down a very influential financial institution because the government allowed it to fail. That's the key between then and now. It was allowed to fail.
So this guy, Jay Cooke, he was actually a real villain. You know, he bribed two vice presidents. He bought members of Congress. He was really feared by politicians.
Yeah, no doubt about it, but interestingly enough, and a wonderful old right writer named John T. Flynn made the point that Jay Cooke, despite all those despicable things, was considered the country's leading banker because he also donated a lot of money. He was a big philanthropist, so a lot of people in the public thought this guy was a great guy.
So he stole from the average guy and everyone, and then he gave some to have smooth over his reputation.
Absolutely.
So really his operation was kind of a predecessor, even a model, for the Federal Reserve, wasn't it?
Yeah, and in fact he was granted a number of bank charters, and he helped set up the banking system. So he was a very influential guy.
Well, you know, one other little side note that I appreciated was that, you know, President Grant has been vilified for a lot of reasons by historians, and in this particular story, for not responding to the crisis soon enough and not bailing out the big banks, but actually him allowing Jay Cooke to fail was really the right thing to do, and we have him substantially to thank for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, members of Congress, and nobody could imagine this today because, and again, we have to kind of back up and remind the audience, there was no Federal Reserve during this period, during the 1880s. There was no lender of last resort. Now Ben Bernanke can step in and drive rates to zero and bail a company like Jay Cook out. Well, this wasn't the case at the time, so it was actually debated in Congress, and there were actually 60 inflation bills that were introduced into Congress. Congress debated these bills. They passed an inflation bill of 1874 that would have flooded the market with money. And Ulysses S. Grant actually vetoed that bill, even though his party was very much behind it. But he believed that inflation would destroy the credit of the nation.
Mm-hmm. So he actually, in 1874, or was it 75, signed the Resumption of Specie Act.
Yeah, actually, it was made effective in 1878, and it was made effective on January 1st, 1879, to put the country back on the gold standard. So, as I make a point in the piece, of course, Ulysses S. Grant has the reputation of a guy who was inebriated most of the time, but he seemed to show some pretty good sense, despite being on the sauce, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this 1880s a little bit more and the prosperity that, you know, really continued for the next two decades after that. You know, you put down some phenomenal points here about from 1879 to 1896, you know, the production expanded, product rose at a rate of 3.7% per year. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think the key thing for people to remember, and especially for the average person, is that, you know, as prices kept falling, wages actually went up. Wages rose by 23%, and since there was no inflation, real wages soared. And Rothbard made the case that no decade before or since has produced such a sustainable rise in real wages. And when we have real wages, people can save money, capital can be formed, and through that, business becomes more efficient and the economy becomes more robust. Productivity was nearly 4% a year. GDP growth almost doubled in the 1880s. There's never been a decade since that has been this productive. Subsequent to a tremendous financial crash, there were two decades of extraordinary productivity and extraordinary real wage growth.
Now, there was a short, very short, lasting only 3 weeks, panic in 1884, but since there was no Federal Reserve, no lender of last resort, no central bank to flood the market with liquidity, when that hit, it only lasted 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the story because there wasn't a central bank involved doesn't mean there wasn't a market. There was a market, and there was a market for interest rates, but interest rates were rational. And when I say rational, they priced in risk. The overnight money rate rose to 4% per day. Not per annum. And, I mean, that's essentially a rate that you might get at your local payday loan store these days. But people who had to borrow did pay that. And if there was no cheap credit, then, the lesser players, fell away. They went bankrupt. Their assets were redistributed at lower prices to more productive users. And as historians have written, that crisis only lasted 3 weeks, as opposed to this crisis of 2008, which is still going on and I fear may go on possibly for another decade or two, just as Japan's downturn has.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this thing that you put in the piece and was brought up by Pat a couple of minutes ago about how prices have kept falling 1% per year, but wages rose by 23% during this entire period. So there was no inflation. Real wages, they soared. And you mentioned these three conditions that Rothbard has stated that are required for a rise in real wages. Would you outline those again?
Yeah, it's Murray makes the point that it takes an absence of inflation and increases in savings and capital formation to produce a rise in real wages. And that's what was occurring in the 1880s. But let's think about 2008 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have an absence of inflation? No.
Mm-hmm.
We have a slight increase in savings, but that's after multiple decades of the savings rate essentially going to zero.
Actually,
below zero. And we've had very little capital formation.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what's going on since the financial bust is that there has been a deleveraging. There is a, you know, the banking, commercial banking system is shrinking, so that would mean kind of an absence of inflation, if you will. People are starting to save more, and through that savings they would form capital. But unfortunately, the central bank and Washington, D.C. with their policies are working against those things. They're trying to prop up the price of houses. They're trying to prop up the price of cars. They are trying to get people not to save but to spend money again.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they can create capital by just printing it out of thin air. So they're essentially working against the process that's trying to cleanse the economy and to cleanse these malinvestments that have taken place over the last decade or so.
You know, before we leave this whole conversation about the 1800s, I just wanted to make a couple other points that I gathered from studying your work on this, Doug. You mentioned that the GDP, the gross domestic product, almost doubled in the 1880s. You know, and this is a decade where there was an explosion of business startups, labor productivity increased by over 26%, business startups increased, you know, 500%. There was incredible farm productivity, and as you mentioned, capital formation roughly doubled, while all the commodity prices were falling. Farm wages were also increasing. You know, so the most powerful bank in the country fails. What follows is a couple of decades of prosperity with the with no too big to fail policy and no worry about systemic risk. So, you know, not only did, as you say, life go on, but the economy really flourished. So, I loved your comment here. Let's go back to 2008. Susie Orman tells Larry King, thank God they bailed out AIG. And these other guys all promoting the bailouts and the stimulus as being the way to go. And this is just complete backwards thinking.
It's exactly the opposite of what should be going on, and it's really too bad. And again, we have people writing history that says the 1880s were this terrible black hole of depression, when in fact it was by all accounts a great transformation in the economy. And and despite these great transformations, and these increase in business startups and increase in productivity and wages, there was no inflation because we had we were on a gold standard during part of this, and the banking system or one of the big players in the banking system was allowed to fail. So people should be able to see what the lack of inflation, or to look at it another way, what the benefits of deflation really are. And we can see those very readily in the 1880s, But the average reader, as they go to Wikipedia or some of these other sources, will be misled.
You know, if you're going to suggest the average listener here today hearing this and being bombarded constantly with this notion that deflation is the big risk, that we barely made it from going over into the abyss and so on, what would be the first couple of books or lectures that you would recommend that they listen to or read that I know would be available on the Mises.org website?
Well, the first one you mentioned, and he's the guy who's really doing a lot of work on this, and it's Guido Holzmann's Deflation and Liberty. And this book is very short. It's 46 pages. It's a wonderful book, and actually it was a book that he wrote as he was writing a larger book that I would very much recommend called The Ethics of Money Production. So both of these books by Guido Holzmann are just wonderful treatments of this subject. And if anyone wants to read further into the kind of the 1880s banking history that we've been talking about, History of Money and Banking in the United States, The Colonial Era to World War II, by Mr. Murray Rothbard.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Folks, we're going to come back right after the break. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, talking with Mr. Doug French and Mr. Patrick Barron of the University of Iowa. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and our special commentator, Patrick Barron, the University of Iowa, wanted to jump in here. Pat, please go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to make a point about we can all see a concrete example of a difference in how the government handled things in 1873 and how they handled things in 2008. I just recall that in 2008, shortly after the presidential election and shortly after the first stimulus bill had been passed, but of course nothing had really been funded from that bill, the price of gasoline here in Iowa was falling, and I remember that it went below $1.70 a gallon. Today in Iowa City, I just filled up, it's $2.74 a gallon. So that is money right out of my pockets. It's a dollar and a nickel or so more expensive, which as a percentage increase in a mere 16 months, the price of gasoline has gone up 63%. So there's an example of instead of allowing prices to fall and cleanse the market and that would reflect reality of things, we're propping up all these things, and therefore we're getting back into stagflation where we have a stagnant economy and inflation.
Doug, you know, I wanted to jump in here and mention this other thing that Pat just brings up, is that one of the most important parts of economics that is really being ignored by the Keynesians is this need for cleansing, that bankruptcies are an important part, that inefficient firms must go out of business. And so would you comment that on that?
Yeah, we have to have that in a capitalist system. I mean, there's always, you've had Yuri Maltsev on your show many times, and Yuri tells all these stories in the Soviet Union under socialism that they would just produce shoes or whatever it may be with no relevance to the market. And think they were growing their GDP when in fact there was no market for what they were producing. And in the capitalist system, we were all better off by the factors of production being in the hands of the most efficient. And it is, as we've talked earlier in the program, it is inflation that hides the inefficient, and as government intervenes, they keep the Fannie Mae's, the Freddie Mac's, the Citicorp's, the car companies in business, essentially to waste resources. And that's what's going on. Whereas deflation, will make those firms go bankrupt and those factors of production will be put into the hands of the more efficient.
I wanted to squeeze in here a section from Guido Holzmann's book, Deflation and Liberty, on the 6 points on why deflation is the harbinger of liberty, as he says it. Number one, it stops inflation. Number two, it destroys the institutions that produce inflation. Number three, It abolishes the advance that inflation-based debt finance enjoys over savings-based equity finance. It decentralizes financial decision-making, makes banks, firms, and individuals more prudent and self-reliant, and it eradicates the rechanneling of income that result from the monopoly privileges of central banks, and thus destroys the economic basis of the false elites, and, as he says, obliges them to become true elites rather than quickly or abdicate and make way for new entrepreneurs and other social leaders. And I just love that quote. So, Doug, I'm going to give you the last few words on this.
And well, in Guido's words, the only path to liberty is really through deflation. And as government promotes inflation, they are promoting exactly the opposite. So we should all be rooting for deflation.
So thank you very much, Doug French and Patrick Barron, for being with us today. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at RadioFreeMarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.